This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Berkeley physicist Carl Haber recently was named a MacArthur Fellow for his work finding long-lost sounds and digitally restoring them. He's brought the voices of Alexander Graham Bell and Jack London back to life with a special high-definition camera that reads the patterns off broken discs and other recordings and turns them into sound. And the newly minted MacArthur genius joins us in studio for this segment of our program. Welcome to you and congratulations.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, delighted to have you here. I thought maybe before we begin, we could actually hear one of these cuts. An example, one of the earliest recordings that you restored. It's the voice of Alexander Graham Bell from 1885. And in the sound we're about to hear, Alexander Graham Bell says, you may not be able to make it out, but try your best. This record has been made by Alexander Graham Bell in the presence of Dr. Chichester A. Bell on the 15th of April, 1885 at the Volta Laboratory. And there's a lot of static, but let's see if you can make out the words. That again was a recording of Alexander Graham Bell back from 1885, digitally restored by the Berkeley Lab Recorded Sound Restoration Project, and Carl Haber is the genius behind all that. First of all, I mean, congratulations again on the MacArthur, but I got to ask you, this is from material of hardcover books, I believe, is it not?
Well, the actual disc that it came from was made of wax, which was a coating on top of what they called binder board, which is very similar to what a hardcover book would be covered with. So that was what it was physically made of.
But it was recording on the wax?
Exactly, on wax.
And this is three-dimensional photography to actually get the voice.
Right. So the recording that was done, it looks somewhat like a phonograph record, but it's a disc. But the groove actually went up and down into the wax rather than side to side. So we had to use a kind of three-dimensional camera in order to capture the images of that additional dimension, that being up and down.
So they call a gigapixel camera?
Well, the camera itself actually has only 180 pixels, but we scan it very slowly over the surface of the object. So we accumulate hundreds of millions or even a billion actual pixel measurements that then get sort of synthesized into an image.
This is really ingenious, but I think we should mention it was inspired by an NPR report about a decade ago, wasn't it?
Correct. I was driving up the Nimitz Freeway coming back from working at a company down in Silicon Valley who was building some equipment for us for our high energy physics research, and I heard something, I don't know if it was NPR, it was certainly KQED, and it was a discussion about sound recordings and their fragility and their importance and the fact that they were at risk. And the problem just seemed to have some solutions in some other things that we were doing already in our own technical work. And that was really what the project grew out of. So, yes, I was listening to KQED.
We're pleased about that. Tell us about Irene. And I don't mean our producer who booked you.
So we've built a number of sort of, you can call them machines, that do this scanning and then the analysis of the data and the acquisition of the data. And we called the first one Irene. We like that name because essentially the first recording that we demonstrated the concept on was a recording of the Weavers doing Goodnight Irene, which is a Lead Belly composition, but it was the Weavers' much sort of sweet version of it. So we were really in love with the name Irene, and then it worked out to be a good acronym, which was Image, Reconstruct, Erase Noise, etc. And so etc. gave it the possibility of doing other things, and we like that. So the technology has been referred to now pretty much universally as Irene, and Irene is a machine. It's cameras and motion control and computers and a big table that isolates it from vibrations, and the media gets put on the table and it gets measured and then analyzed.
There's so much that this new technology can restore. I mean, not only lost voices, so you've got Thomas Edison's voice, but I know, in fact, I want to hear some of these Native American recordings you restored from the early 20th century. In other words, going back to cultures that may even be extinct and bringing back those sounds.
Right. So the interesting thing about the if you call it the archive, that would be the totality of whatever has been held by all the museums and libraries and so forth. If you look at that archive, there's a bit of stuff in there that represents the development of the technology. So that was this Alexander Graham Bell. Then there's the birth of the recording industry and music and the commercial aspect. And then there's all the ethnographic and anthropological linguistic work that was done to document cultures, essentially a world in transition, a world that was changing. Anthropologists, linguists, ethnographers, they were the among the first early users of sound recording as a research tool. They pretty much by 1900 realized that this was going to be an invaluable method for documenting language, culture, song, story. And there's thousands and thousands of such recordings on all sorts of essentially arcane or obsolete media in key collections all over the world. And I think, yes, that is a really important area where the technology, I think, can make a contribution. So we've done a little bit of work on pilot projects with the Hearst Museum at Berkeley, with the Burke Museum in Seattle, and a number of others. And I think, yes, that's a really important direction.
Well, in fact, soon after you were inspired by KQED, I believe you went to the Arthur Kroeber Collection at UC Berkeley, the Phoebe Hearst Museum of Anthropology. And we have a cut here, an example of a wax cylinder recording, dates back to 1912. It's a recording of Ishi. You may know that name. Those of you who know Arthur Kroeber's groundbreaking and pioneer work in anthropology. He's the only surviving member of the Yahi at the time, telling the story of the wood duck. Tell us about that.
So I think many, many Californians are familiar with the story of Ishi, this man who came to live at the University of California and was recorded and interviewed and interacted in a very significant way with Professor Kroeber and all of his associates for 4 or 5 years before he passed away. So Kroeber, Waterman, and the others, they made, I think it was like 300 cylinders recordings, each about two or three minutes long, of Ishi. The wood duck is a story that goes on for something like 53 cylinders. So they were recording him and swapping cylinders in and out as the story played out. All in all, there's something like 3,000 recordings in the collection that span all of California Native American language, culture, history from that early period, 1900 to somehow in the late 19s. And it represents the Miwok, the Yurok, the Yokut, all the different groups that spanned California. There's a huge amount of linguistic diversity among Californians of that time.
How much of that can actually be restored? I know you've taken some unplayable and degraded discs and cylinders, things that have been linked to glass and rubber and beeswax and tinfoil, but how much can actually be restored?
I mean, if things are missing, if a recording is broken and there are pieces of it that are just not there, we can't, pull a rabbit out of a hat. There's no magic. But what we can do is we can pretty much play anything that has a groove in it, which may be too delicate to touch otherwise, may be too damaged to touch otherwise. If it's got a groove, we can pretty much image it and play it in some way. In the case of these field recordings, many of them are still in whole condition. They're not broken, but there are significant items which are broken. Some of them have been attacked by mold, which is a biological process that eats into the wax. If the wax is gone, obviously we can't bring it back. But we can pretty much play anything that's actually still there in some way. And we have played discs and cylinders which were broken by essentially scanning the individual pieces and linking them together digitally.
We're talking really about kind of three areas that you've been working in. I mean, libraries and museums on the one hand, but also the commercial and the field.
Yes.
And I thought we could maybe hear a few more examples. Before we do, though, I mean, what about mass use of this? I mean, there's a center in India, it's my understanding, and there's one in progress in Andover, Massachusetts?
Correct. So the vision of this technology, and it's really been guided by the Library of Congress, which is a very, very close collaborator with us on this project, is to make the technology available more and more widely. So in 2006, we built a system that we put at the Library of Congress. There are now two systems at the library. And so those are being used and can be used essentially to deal with other federal collections, collections at the Smithsonian, collections at the National Archives, and other federal holders, of which is a very significant number. We are now building a machine that's going to be put at the Northeast Document Conservation Center in Andover, Mass. That is a center that offers conservation services to libraries and museums that are, say, too small to have their own infrastructure, but still have books or paper or other things that need conservation treatment, and now they're going to be able to do that for these audio carriers using the Irene methods. There are discussions underway to put machines in facilities in Europe where, again, there are many, many important collections in Europe, and perhaps in even bordering areas now becomes logistically more possible to move collections over land, over shorter distances, where they can get these kind of restorations. We also have a machine at the Muttiah Research Library in Madras, India, and Chennai, sorry. And that is there because there's a very significant early 20th century collection, essentially of commercial recordings that were created in India at the time. It was the British Gramophone Company then set up its South Asian operations there in India, and a lot of material was created in India in the early 20th century.
So you're going to use some of this MacArthur money for seed money then too?
Well, so in the mid 2000s, we got pretty good support for this technology development from various federal funders. A lot of the money that we have now is very targeted at, you know, work on the Bell recordings or work on this particular set. And I think what the MacArthur money lets us do is kind of open up the whole thing again to be able to explore new opportunities, things that come along, changes in the technology. We can adapt, and I think we can be a lot more nimble with that kind of open-ended. It seems quite open-ended because it's going to cover something like 5 years. So I think it gives us just a lot of now flexibility to look at what interesting things come up and how to deal with them.
Talking to Carl Haber, who is a senior scientist in the physics division at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, recently named a MacArthur Fellow for 2013, and for his work actually finding long-lost sounds and digitally restoring them. He's brought the voices of Alexander Graham Bell, which you heard earlier, and Jack London back to life with a special high-definition camera that reads the patterns off broken discs and other recordings and turns them into sound. Well, we'd like to hear from you if you'd like to join this conversation. If you have questions or comments for us or would simply like to join in, you can do that now. Our toll-free number is available, and we welcome your calls. 866-733-6786 is the number to call. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786, or you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or join us by going to our website, kqed.org/forum. And clicking on the segment or tweeting us, and our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. And I just want to maybe get kind of, I know explaining particle physics is a very formidable challenge, to put it mildly, but the optical equipment from the lab actually gets, just to understand this on a lay level, gets images of subatomic particles, right?
So you're asking about the connection.
Yeah.
Okay, so basically
I mean, you're extracting the sound, but you're doing it through physics.
Well, I'll tell you. So mostly what I do in particle physics at the lab is to develop, you might call them cameras for imaging radiation. And we build thousands of these objects, they're maybe the size of your hand, that get arrayed around the collision point at CERN, for example, at the Large Hadron Collider. So that's where my physics research is based, at CERN. And these cameras, if you like, in order to make them properly, we had to develop a whole suite of measurement techniques to kind of survey their shapes very, very accurately. So we were doing that in the late 90s and early 2000s, you know, every day in order to build and calibrate this big array that was going to go to CERN. I was really impressed with these measurement techniques, which were all optical. And I was just thinking, there must be other things that we can do with such a nice optical measurement tool to characterize surfaces in different ways. I heard the story about the sound recordings, and I just thought, this could be a very nice application of the same measurement technique that we were using to build our radiation cameras. We could purpose that in this other way. So when we started to actually look into it and do it, we realized that the data that gets created when you do such a measurement on a phonograph record and the way you analyze that data has a lot of mathematical or algorithmic commonality with the way we deal with large data sets in physics research. So there was a commonality based on how we measure, and then there was a commonality with the sort of analysis approach and the mindset of how you process data, how you statistically bring signals out of noise, and so forth. So it's not that we had a camera that we were using to take a picture of an elementary particle, and then we used the same camera to photograph a disk. That's not really what actually happened. It was really we had a technique for measurement, we had a way of analyzing data, and we saw a way to essentially purpose some of those same tools to this other problem.
So it's a mathematical extraction.
Yes.
Yeah. Before I go to calls and emails, a lot of people want to talk to you, and I want to read the emails we're getting here. And again, you can feel free to join us at our toll-free number, which is 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org. I want to hear one of the recordings that the Berkeley Lab also digitally restored from a broken disk, because you had spoken earlier about the difficulty of that. And this is, you're about to hear a recording from a shellac disk that had shattered into six pieces. And I wanted to bring this in because I grew up in Cleveland and used to hear polka all the time as a boy. This is actually fragments that were screened and digitally reassembled, and it's the Louis Prima Polka.
Sing it right away. Now here is what you say, so sing it while you may. Here's a silly jingle, you can sing it night or noon. Here's the words, that's all you need, because I just sang the tune. Oh,
all right, that was Louis Prima and his orchestra doing the Too Fat Polka, but you have to know that it was digitally reassembled by the Berkeley Lab and was originally recorded in the late 1940s. Let me go to your calls, and we'll begin with Ray. Hi, Ray, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I was wondering, I was recently reading John Chadwick's book on the decipherment of linear B. You know, the primary materials for a lot of those carved languages are not exactly available. But I was thinking that it could be scanned and put into STL files, and then we could do a 3D print of, you know, you could have your own fragment of some of the things from Knossos or some of the Phoenician writings. And I was wondering, you're taking things out of the 3D realm to get the information. Have you thought about trying to put some of that back into the 3D realm, perhaps in a form that's more accessible to other people? And thanks for the project. It's great information.
You're welcome, and thanks for your call. I think what you're saying is, could we take this a step further and essentially use 3D printing to reprint a record back into the physical world based on this data? I suppose in principle that could be done. I don't believe that the resolution of today's 3D printers approach the resolution that you would need to do a good restoration of a sound recording. I don't believe there would be any technical reason to do this, because once you're in the digital realm, what would be the point of going back to the analog world again? Except maybe for novelty or just for the physical experience of holding an object in your hand. But certainly, if you go out of the realm of sound recordings to other artifacts, yes, in principle, art objects of art and archaeology are and can be digitally scanned in 3D and could be 3D printed back into the physical world if you wanted to do that.
Well, here's kind of a related question. Chan writes, I've followed Dr. Haber's work with enormous interest. How long will it be before I can purchase a product that will allow me to touchlessly digitize my huge collection of classical vinyl. How long before folks in the maker community will be able to construct such equipment? Sign me up for that.
Well, actually, there is a machine that's been available since at least the 1980s called the laser turntable, which can play your vinyl records touchlessly. It's, I think, $10,000 or $15,000 or even maybe more. It's called the ELP. I don't know its availability anymore, but it's certainly a machine that existed. Our approach is actually different. What we're trying to do is to create a digital image of the entire surface and use all the information there to overcome the effects of degradation, to play the material back, to reassemble broken things. The commercial laser players, according to the audio engineers that I've talked to, seem to work well on vinyl discs that are in good condition, but not on things that are distressed, in bad shape, delicate, falling apart, and so forth, which is really where we focused our effort. In terms of, you know, when an Irene-like machine would be a commercial product, I can't answer the question. It's not something that I've given a lot of thought to. I've concluded that it was sort of an expensive proposition and didn't seem like it would have a good kind of commercial angle there. So I'm really working in the research community with a scientific instrument.
I think I saw a quote where you called this a huge hallmark in the history of science. It really is.
Well, actually, I was misquoted. What I was saying was that the development of sound recording was a huge hallmark.
Well, they both are. Let me get another caller on. Walter joins us. Hi, Walter. You're on.
Good morning. Thanks for the interesting information today. I have some curiosity regarding how you determine historical significance and what criteria are used to determine which of these recordings, broken or otherwise, are actually digitized using your methodology. I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. That's a very interesting question. And, I mean, the short answer is that we are developing the technology, and we have partnered with libraries and museums who are the caretakers and the stakeholders, if you like, in these materials. And so it's pretty much for them to decide what the priority is and what the ordering is of materials. A lot of what's been done so far in terms kind of milestone recordings, there are only a very small number of really historical recordings from the period of invention, say Edison, Bell, Leon Scott. And pretty much you can count those on a few fingers of a couple of hands. And so whenever there is that can be dealt with, we are trying to make our way through those particular things. As you get into the realm of thousands of discs and cylinders, field work, or the other things, musical, beginning of the recording industry, I think it's really for the archivists, the researchers, the historians to make the decision on what order and what priority things should be digitized.
Well, you mentioned Edison. We actually have a clip that predates Edison's recording of Mary Had a Little Lamb by nearly two decades, and I think this is considered to be the earliest recording ever of a human voice. It's difficult to make out, but a man is singing Au Clair de Lune. It was recorded in 1860 and was using a phone autograph. Tell us a little bit about a phone autograph before we hear this.
So the phone autograph was a machine that was invented by Leon Scott de Martinville, who was a French printer, bookseller, and, of course, inventor. And he built a machine that recorded sound on paper. So the paper was coated with lampblack, basically soot, and he caused a pig's bristle to vibrate in sympathy with sound, and the vibration of the pig's bristle scratched a waveform into the soot and exposed the white paper beneath it. Very cleverly, he also recorded a tuning fork at the same time, so it was a two-track recording, and he provides posterity with a time base, which is an amazing thing to do in 1860 before anybody had ever recorded sound. His vision was to record sound on paper because other people had recorded images on paper. He was impressed by photography. His system had no playback method associated with it. It was purely a recording. And, of course, today, with access to these original recordings, you can now digitize them, and you can, using computer algorithm, follow the movement of the pig's bristle and the movement of the tuning fork and reconstruct the sound that he recorded. And this was done in 2008.
Well, before we hear this, just a little excerpt from 1860 and the singing of Clair de Lune, a number of people have asked whether ancient sounds could possibly be captured from the grooves in pottery that were made with a scratching tool.
Okay, so this is called archaeoacoustics, and it is a kind of Mythbusters sort of topic. Many people have brought this up over the years, and we've even been contacted by people about this question. My judgment of this is that the answer is no. I really think that to record sound was a very deliberate process, and you really have to then kind of understand what the process was that they used. And fortunately, they've documented what Bell and Edison and Leon Scott, they documented what they did, and we were able to basically back engineer what they did from their information. If sound was recorded kind of accidentally, and there are a number of kind of schemes where people have suggested, like a little brush vibrating when a pot is spinning in the wet clay. I mean, you'd have to really understand what was going on. And I think to record sound, it was a very deliberate process, and you have to really match the materials and the recording transduction process. And I just don't think it happened accidentally.
Well, let's hear this first recording. Well, that was the earliest recording of the human voice.
Yes,
singing
yes.
Au Clair de Lune. Yeah.
Right, that was. That was presumably Leon Scott himself, very slowly. But if you listen to the tune and you listen to this, it's clearly Au Clair de la Lune.
It's 1860. That's fascinating stuff. Thank you for being with us. Congratulations
Thank you.
The MacArthur Grant and onward and upward. Carl Haber, Senior Scientist, Physics Division, Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, recently named MacArthur Fellow for 2013. We are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Forums produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from Chad McClymans. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and executive producer is Raul Ramirez. For all of us here at KQED, thank you for being a part of this morning's program. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.